where I come to Writing the Wrong Way, where we talk about how writing works, how writers work, why the best writers risk being strange. And one of the great writers that we've had in the past, of course, is H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells wrote so many seminal works of science fiction, you know, The Time Machine, War of the Worlds, the two big obvious ones. But one of the other great Wells stories is, of course, The Island of Dr. Moreau. And I want to analyze The Island of Dr. Moreau a little bit for you here. In the course of doing so, I'm going to talk about psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic theory. I think that psychoanalytic theory is a really fascinating approach to literature. I don't know how useful it really is in terms of your psychology, but it's a very useful analytical approach in other respects. And I'm going to talk a bit about Zizekian interpretations of psychoanalytic theory. I'm going to give you a bit of context and an explainer. So if you don't know what psychoanalytic theory is, I'm going to kind of break it down quickly and simply for you in its broad terms, as far as the concept of the big other is concerned, and you know how Zizek might be using this, how Lacan kind of uses this. It's an idea that comes out of Freud, although he's not really saying this precise thing. But then, of course, I'm moving it all towards talking about The Island of Dr. Moreau. I think The Island of Dr. Moreau is a brilliant and fascinating book in a lot of ways. And it's a great thing to look at for writers, in part because it has this, I think, brilliant thematic structure that's very complex, but also in many ways, it's subdued. You know, there is, I think, a really complicated way to read The Island of Dr. Moreau, which is how I would like to read it for you here. I'm going to kind of analyze it, give you my take on The Island of Dr. Moreau. I haven't really seen other people offer this take. Maybe I just missed it. So maybe it's not as original as I think, but I do think I have a pretty unique take on Dr. Moreau here. I think it's the kind of thing that is worth just kind of listening to, you know, hear what I got to say about it. If you like the book, you know, see what you think about it. Let me know if you agree, let me know if you disagree. But just as a writer, if you don't care much about Moreau or Wells, I think it's a masterclass, this book, in how to kind of write an antagonist figure like Moreau in this very complicated fashion with a real character psychology that comes out in interesting ways. So I'm going to kind of again, crash course you in the psychoanalytic theory of the Zizekian stripe. I'm going to analyze Dr. Moreau a little bit. I'm going to give my take on it. And I'm going to do this all in a context where I think I'm going to hopefully, I think, show you how I believe writers can really learn how to build a constructed character who has these sorts of deep needs, these deep motivations that maybe they themselves aren't really aware of, but we as writers, you know, need to be aware of. So without further ado, we're going to dive into that. And if you enjoy this and you've been enjoying this podcast or enjoying my analyses or my interviews with people, please do sign up to my newsletter at strangeinc.ca. If you go to strangeinc.ca, you can sign up for my newsletter. That's, you know, an email that I send out. It's an email you can reply to. It goes right to me. This is the best way for us to keep in touch. And I'll keep recommending things to you. I'll keep, you know, offering my ideas and analyses to you. I'll keep giving out writing tips. You know, I got lots of things to share with you. And then you can also hit me back. Let me know what you think. You know, do you like this take on Moreau or whatever is on your mind? What recommendations do you have for me? You know, strangeinc.ca is the way in to, you know, a good kind of structure. Let's just let the Zuckerbergs have and the Musks have their, you know, little toys out in the world. We don't need all that. We can connect directly to one another through our email if you go to strangeinc.ca. But now, let's dive into The Island of Dr. Moreau. We're gonna burn every breath down and kick your teenage tombstones down. to take some of Žižek's, Slavoj Žižek's ideas, which of course he's drawing and altering from Sigmund Freud. So just to sort of give you a really quick historical lesson here, Sigmund Freud, of course, you know, is the father of modern psychology in some ways, but certainly of psychoanalysis, the particular field of psychology that has been built on Freud's early psychological work. So Freud invented psychoanalysis. You can jump down the line and see other people refining it or pulling it in different directions, or, you know, abandoning it for their own thing, as Jung to some degree did. But there's a real clear line to a modern figure like Žižek, who is really taking psychoanalysis, divorcing it in some ways from psychology, and utilizing it in philosophy. Žižek's specific interest as a philosopher, and he is primarily a philosopher, is in dialectical materialism and certain Marxist and Hegelian notions, which he has combined with the work of Lacan, who is another major figure in psychoanalysis. Lacan follows Freud and reinvents Freud for his era, this postmodernist, post-structuralist era in the mid to late 20th century. Žižek follows Lacan and is, again, reinventing psychoanalysis for the modern day. And without getting further into the deep, deep dive on Žižek, let's just simply say here we have a reinvention of psychoanalysis, a reinvention of Freudian theory, specifically designed to be of use in literary and film analysis and in cultural studies. So Žižek is primarily a philosopher and a cultural theorist. You'll see that he uses in his lecture on ideology, what he calls Pervert's Guide to Ideology, because he's perverting, in some ways, twisting standard interpretations of ideology and also of psychoanalysis. It's also a bit of a joke, but Žižek is sort of tweaking and changing, twisting some of the common ideas about ideology, even as he explains them, through the psychoanalytic lens, again, building off of the work of Freud and later Lacan. And I want to take some of these Žižekian concepts and just apply them to Moreau to give you maybe an idea of how Žižek might understand or look at something like The Island of Dr. Moreau. I'm not 100% aware of everything Žižek has written because, of course, it's not possible to be so. I don't think Žižek even knows everything that he's written. Žižek is famously criticized often for rewriting himself. He sometimes will, if you read a Žižek book, actually, I wrote a book where at one time I quote Žižek, and in the quotation citation, I actually found two different books where he had the exact same text verbatim where he'd quoted himself, or, you know, what people call self-plagiarism, which of course is a ridiculous term, but people often use it to criticize Žižek. So I don't know exactly what Žižek has said or if he said anything about Moreau. I'm not aware of anything he said directly about The Island of Dr. Moreau. Similarly, I'm not aware of anything Freud has said about The Island of Dr. Moreau or Wells. Freud would have certainly known The Island of Dr. Moreau. Freud was personal friends with Wells. But nevertheless, what I think I want to do here, just to, one, give us a reading of The Island of Dr. Moreau, but two, show you how psychoanalysis, particularly the Žižekian form of psychoanalysis, can be applied to a literary text like The Island of Dr. Moreau. Now, you can do this kind of reading with other texts. That's the whole point of looking into psychoanalysis as a literary theory. If you look at The Island of Dr. Moreau, and if you look at Žižek's lecture, his explanations of some of these core psychological concepts, one of the terms he brings up is the notion of the big other. So the big other is this other, you know, so in psychoanalysis, we talk about subjects, you know, I'm a subject, you're a subject. you're instantiated as a subject. You know, you have a, in other words, a consciousness. You're a person who has consciousness. You're a subject. And then we also talk in psychoanalysis about objects in various ways. And then there's also this idea called the other. The other is other subjects. So, you know, you are you, I am me. For me, you are the other. For you, I am the other. And then there's more extreme versions of the other. You know, if we have certain similarities as part of the same cultural background and so on, there may be some other for both of us, in the sense of, you know, our culture as a whole might be considered to have an other that it refers to in some way, shape, or form. So again, you know, often a foreign culture or foreign identity. So very much, you know, we're bound up in identity politics on a certain level here. But there's this idea, this notion in psychoanalysis of the other. You know, there's a subject, and the subject perceives an other. And fundamentally, the important thing here is the subject perceives themselves as different from the other. So this is a very complicated thing in psychoanalysis that I don't think we need to delve into too fully. But the core idea here is the subject perceives themselves as a subject. They perceive the other as outside of themselves, as another subject, perhaps, or as some other thing that they can't fully comprehend. But then there is this other, what Zizek likes to call the big other, which is this idea of an observing other. So, and often the big other is an authority of some sort. So the big other could be a government authority. So talking about the state as the big other, you know, this observing force that again is surveilling us, or we at least understand or believe to be surveilling us on various ways. You know, the government knows what you owe them in taxes. They will come for your taxes. You know, this is the big other making a demand on you. In that case, a financial sense, but also there's, you know, the big other as a surveiller of morality or legality. You know, the big other, the state has created laws that you must observe the laws. The state has its agents, you know, these smaller others, you know, the police, for example, to enforce the laws. And again, there's a subject feels at the mercy of the big other in particular ways. The subject feels observed by the big other in particular ways, and so on. And again, I use the state as the example of the big other, but anything else could be the big other as long as it fits a structural position. So often in religious viewpoints, God is the big other. The two great big others in psychoanalysis are God and the state. But it, you know, technically speaking, a lot of other things could be the big other. You know, your corporate boss, you know, the CEO is the big other in a manner of speaking. Even if the CEO is a person you in the company you work for, even if the CEO is never present, even if you don't even know who the CEO is, there's a level at which you feel observed by that person in terms of they have their agents, you know, your boss perhaps, who is managing you, who is observing you, who is, and if you perform improperly, you have the idea that you know the big other will destroy you. Right, you will be punished by, you know, maybe your boss or HR or whatever, but they're representing this other thing that gives them authority. So this idea that authority doesn't reside precisely where you're, you know, being punished from so much as it resides in this other position. Again, Thomas Hobbes considered this, gave us a metaphor of the Leviathan, right? The state as the king as the representative of God. Which, you know, itself is a representative of law or whatever you want to, you know, call it. So there's a few essential observations that Zizek makes about the big other that, you know, he covers in that lecture. Now let's just jump to Moreau for a second. There's obviously a clear way in which in the Island of Dr. Moreau, Moreau himself is operating as the big other for those animal men, right? He's transformed through vivisection, these animals into these quasi-human figures. And for those creatures, Moreau is the big other. He is the source of authority. You know, they have this prayer to him. You know, his is the house of pain, etc. And then also notice, as Prendrick notices, that the authority that is in Moreau is extended beyond his presence. So even when he's not around, they feel observed by him. Even when he's not obviously in charge or control of something, like the ocean, they consider him to be in charge or in control of it. You know, his is the lightning flash, you know, his is the great ocean, right? There's this idea that Moreau is himself representing some larger authority that they can't comprehend. They can only envision, you know, what could be causing the lightning flash in terms and through, you know, Moreau. So there's a level at which he is a other for them in a simple way, like he's not them, he's someone else. But more importantly, he's the big other for them. You know, he represents some larger thing that they can't fully grasp. So there's a sublime dimension to Moreau for them. And this, of course, is why after Moreau's death, Prendric can convince them that he still watches them, right? He's Moreau, the human having died, doesn't matter on a fundamental level because what he represents has not died. You know, there's this way in which the big other still lives. In fact, it lives more fully, you know, and Prendric, again, is presenting this idea. You know, yes, he's not here anymore, but he still watches us. You know, he can see us at all times, right? There's a level at which even though Moreau is absent, he's now in a way more present for them as the big other. Now, eventually that goes away, right? And this is an idea that is also very common in psychoanalysis. And Jacques doesn't get into it in the particular lecture on the ideology that you might've seen in the Perverse Guide to Ideology. He doesn't get into that, this particular idea. But there is an idea in psychoanalysis, particularly in Lacanian, Zizekian brand of psychoanalysis, that the other has to die twice, right? So the thing that you perceive directly in your life to be the representative of the big other has to die. You know, Moreau has to die. But then additionally, the big other as a concept has to die for you to become free of it. In fact, there's a way in which if the local representative, like if Moreau dies, then the big other gets more alive. It becomes sort of this, it gets this zombie life, you know, it's just in a sense more powerful, just like a zombie is, you know, harder to kill than a human in some literature and film. So the big other has to sort of die twice. When a thing and a concept dies, it comes back in a sort of zombie form. This is a insight drawn from Freud, right? That the repressed returns. You know, you might, again, you might feel like when you're a kid, you believe the doll is alive. You grow up, you repress that idea. You know, oh, it turns out the doll's not alive. I understand that now. Freud argues, well, you don't just discard that belief. You would just repress it. You push it down. It's always with you. And it comes back in certain moments. It comes back, you know, when you see the thing late at night in the weird light and it looks like it's looking at you. And now that it's come back, the repressed has returned. You have a horror reaction. You know, it's as if you thought you didn't believe in this, but actually you do. So Jacques is pulling an idea from Lacan that Lacan is pulling from Freud here, although he's not articulating it, you know, as clearly as we can see in the Moreau example. The big other dies, or the representative of the big other dies, but the big other is still alive. You know, it's this conceptual, abstract authority that you feel is looking at you, even when your boss isn't there. You act as if he was there watching, right? In a manner of speaking. Now, that is a very standard psychoanalytical reading of the Island of Dr. Moreau. You know, to see Moreau as a representative of the big other and to explain psychoanalytical concepts through the Island of Dr. Moreau. And that's useful as far as it goes. But Žižek would go further, and I would like to go further. Again, I don't know exactly what Žižek would say, but I would say, and I think probably Žižek would agree with me in this instance, I would say that the real question is not this question of, you know, how is Moreau the big other? I think the real question of this book is for what, or rather, what is the big other for Moreau? We can see clearly that for these animal men, Moreau is the big other on a certain level. But what is the big other for Moreau? In other words, why is Moreau doing all this? Prendric asks that question when Moreau gives his little speech on why he's doing it. But please note that you don't get a satisfactory answer from Moreau. In fact, Moreau argues, Prendric asks specifically, for example, You know, Murrow gives a standard mad scientist kind of answer as well. You know, I don't really care about the ethics of it. Yeah, you know, animals are animals, whatever. Pain's irrelevant, pain's not important, et cetera, et cetera. You know, Murrow dismisses the idea that the animals are in pain. Why even bother with, you know, anesthesia? Pain is so meaningless as a concept. You know, I can stab myself with this knife and not even feel the pain. And he does stab himself with a knife, by the way. But then Predrick, you know, asks him, well, you know, okay, fine. Let's accept the standard explanation, your conscious explanation as to why you're doing this. It still doesn't explain why you're turning animals into humans. Why not just turn animals into other animals or whatever, animals into boxes, you know, turn an animal into some new thing. Why a animal into human? Prendrick asks this. He sees it as absolutely horrendous, first off, in part because, you know, it's objectionable morally to him. Murrow, since he has no interest in morals, just says, well, you know, basically, this is the quote from Dr. Murrow when Murrow was asked this. To this day, I have never troubled about the ethics of the matter. The study of nature makes man at least as remorseless as nature. And he kind of gets into this. But previously, that's just sort of his broad answer, right? But previously, he's asked, you know, well, why humans, though? Why humans? And his answer fundamentally is, this is, you know, here's Prendrick, but I asked him why he had taken the human form as a model. There seemed to me then, and there seems to me still now, a strange wickedness in that choice. But Moreau, you know, dismisses this idea. Moreau says he confessed that he had chosen that form by chance. I might just as well have worked to form sheep and llamas and llamas and sheep, but I suppose there's something in human form that appeals to their artistic mind. Now, that's Moreau's answer, and that's his conscious answer. That may even be why he believes he's doing it. But I think that is a as an answer that doesn't really make any sense. And it particularly doesn't make sense in terms of there being a big other for Moreau. Let's assume that for Moreau there is a big other, as there is for all. What is the big other for Moreau? Again, why is he doing this? Why is he turning animals into men as opposed to doing something else? Well, I think the answer comes in that line about being as remorseless as nature. The true interesting approach here, I think, so my interpretation, and I would argue a strong and psychoanalytic interpretation here, is that it's a mistake to misread the novel the way Moreau and take Moreau seriously and straightforwardly. Moreau seems obsessed with turning animals into humans. But he says that's just a random decision. He doesn't really have an investment in doing it. He just happens to be doing it. He's doing pure research and so on, as Zizek would say. But I would suggest that the opposite is the case. I would suggest that really what Moreau is trying to do here is transform himself, a human, into something, into an inhuman, into an animal. There's a level, I would argue, that really, like the surface level where he's transforming animals and humans is a distraction. What Moreau is really trying to do is transform himself rather than the animals. And he's trying to transform himself beyond being human. Moreau, I would argue, is troubled with his humanity. Look at the things that he's done. So, first off, the fact that he is pursuing such an anti-social scientific experiment. In such a particular way. You know, note, please, this fact that Moreau's experiments in animals are so extreme and are taking such an extreme form that he has effectively been cast out of society. There's no reason he couldn't have simply pursued these experiments in a slightly different way. As Prendrick notes, you know, there's less offensive things you could be doing and just doing the same thing. But Moreau has to do the most offensive thing. Why? Because Moreau wants to be removed from society. Moreau complains that he has been driven to an island, but of course, what he really wants is to be on the island. He has extended himself away from society. He has removed himself from human participation in a social group. In other words, Moreau has broken the social contract. If we look at, you know, what Kant and others say about the social contract, one of the things they say is you must be forced against your will to be part of the social contract and to have the quote-unquote freedom of a person in society. That's not what Moreau wants. Moreau doesn't want the freedom available to humans. Moreau wants the freedom available to the sovereign. Moreau wants to be the god and be the state. He wants to be the beginner. So he needs to perform horrific experiments in order to be rejected by society. Moreover, I would argue that one of the unconscious motivations here is a challenge and a death wish. If Moreau can go again, Moreau claims not to believe in God, and therefore isn't concerned about the abominations of what he's doing. He doesn't concern himself or believe himself to be struck, that he's going to be struck down by God, for example. He, at the same time, he is trying to transform himself into a God in the eyes of these creatures. And I would argue that there's a challenge inherent in that. You know, perhaps, you know, an interesting way to read this novel is that Moreau has a certain death wish. He wants to be disproven. You know, he's much like often a Catholic, lapsed Catholic will do. They'll commit sins just to see if they'll be punished. You know, they don't believe in God, but yet they're committing sins simply to be proven through punishment that they're wrong and that there is a God. And often they become disappointed fundamentally when they're not punished, because, as you know, Zizek often says, the sort of, you know, path towards atheism in many respects, he claims, is through Christianity. You know, you just wake up one day and be an atheist, but, you know, sort of the more hardcore manner into being an atheist is to go through Christianity, to, you know, believe in the death of God, and then, you know, in a sense, fully believe, as opposed to just putting on this appearance of belief that we have. You know, in Christianity, you have the appearance of a belief in the death of God, but in reality, of course, the death of God is proof that God lives even more fully, again, as the big other. If you were to doubly identify with God's death, then you move into atheism. As Zizek notes, that it's hard for people to start there, if only because, you know, according to evolutionary psychology, we have this vestigial way in which our brain wants to believe in things like God. Again, we need the big other, even as atheists, in a manner of speaking, is how Zizek would put it. And often the big other, but the hard thing, as Zizek notes, is for us to realize that there is no big other. Even if there is a God, it's not the God we're envisioning precisely, right? The God that is watching, you know, with great interest when we're doing minor things. Right, and, you know, the state does not truly care much of what we do. One of the interesting aspects of paranoid conspiracy regarding vaccines in recent years is, you know, you have this, you know, conspiracy that the government wants you to take vaccines for different reasons. Often the paranoid version of that is that the government is trying to control you through, you know, giving you a vaccine, and they're going to take control of your life. But fundamentally, if you step back again, in what area does the government not already have control of your life? You go to work, you pay your taxes. What more do they need from you? You're so exhausted from going to work and paying your taxes that you don't necessarily have time to do anything else. You know, your free time, you're not, for the most part, invested in taking down the government. And in fact, even when you do invest yourself in taking down the government, you're working to take down the government actively proves its authority. It gives them an excuse, in a manner of speaking, to use you as an example. Now, of course, there's real actual forms of protest that might be possible. But Zizek would note that, you know, so much of this kind of paranoia is in some ways a distraction, a way that we're distracting ourselves. You know, we maybe subscribe to the paranoid conspiracy that the government's trying to do various things in order to control us, because we don't want to admit that we're already offering total obedience. You know, we're already totally obedient to the state, to the sovereign, to God, whatever you want to, whatever your big other is. You're already acting as if it's observing you and controlling you. And even the smallest, so that in some ways, the only way to sustain that obedience is by pretending that there's some other control that they don't already have. So for Moreau, I would argue, just bringing it down to like a simpler scale of the book, I might argue that Moreau really, although he maintains and presents superiority and a lack of belief in the big other, really is acting as if what he truly wants is to transform himself beyond humanity. He feels inferior. He has a death wish. He seems to have a sadistic interest in transformation, but he also claims to be disinterested in pain. Well, clearly this isn't true. Either he has a massive interest in pain and a sadistic attention to these animals that he's paying. He finds pleasure in their pain, or I might, actually suggest this is the better reading. Perhaps Moreau is a masochist, but one that, unfortunately for him, cannot feel pain. He stabs himself with a knife at one point in the novel and claims that it doesn't hurt him because he's just mastered himself and, has figured out how to do it in such a way that there's no pain involved. I might suggest that Moreau has a secret inferiority complex that is hidden below his superiority complex that he presents. I would suggest perhaps that he is a masochist who just, wishes beyond hope to extend himself to the point where he'll be punished and will be visited with pain. And yet, he's unable to receive the pain he wants. And so he sadistically inflicts it on others, hoping that they'll pay him back with pain, with punishment. I would suggest in many ways that Moreau is, although he claims not to believe, invested in the idea that there is some big other, there's a state that has cast him out. There's a God that will come punish him. Somebody who truly, owns the ocean, who truly is in control of the lightning storm, and that he just hopes beyond hope will stop him. And yet, the true pain and the tragic aspect of Moreau is that, nobody comes to stop him. There is no punishment. Even when he dies, he doesn't prove the existence of a big other so much as become that thing temporarily. And then even, that immortality that he temporarily receives, even that, dies as the animals devolve and just stop being afraid of him. So again, Moreau may present human superiority. He presents the idea that humans are superior to animals. He must transform animals into humans. Why else wouldn't he? He sees nothing wrong with it. He sees them as artistically superior, as well as just generally inherently superior. He presents this, and he even himself, of course, is more superior. Moreau presents the belief that animals are down here, humans are up here. Moreau is above them all. And he has no place in his head for God, for the big other. But I think the psychoanalytical reading that is proper here, and I think makes the book particularly interesting, is to read Moreau as harboring a secret belief in the superiority of animals. All of this activity, what is all this activity for, if not to prove to himself and to the big other that he does believe in the superiority of humans and himself? I mean, it's that protest too much, as Shakespeare might say. He's protesting too much. He's going to exaggerate lengths to establish something that everyone else takes for granted in the society. Everyone in that society of that day just takes for granted that humans are superior to animals. And yet Moreau seems hell-bent on proving it. What I think it starts to offer is this interpretation where we can really read Moreau as fundamentally in his secret heart, harboring a belief in the superiority of animals. He's jealous of them, of their ability to operate in a state of nature. He's jealous of how they don't exist in society. He's jealous of how they don't have a belief in the big other. They have actually, in a manner, evolved to a point that he hasn't yet gotten to. All of this trappings of humanity and civilization, society, and the big other has come in, is produced and separated humans from the animals in a fundamental way. Moreau, in a sense, is jealous of the animal nature, of its simplicity, of its lack, its freedom, the freedom of the state of nature, the freedom from the big other. He wants to return to that state. He's attempted to do so by moving to the island. He separated himself from society and so on, but he cannot shake Big Other. Even when he becomes god of the island, there's a manner in which it's not enough for him. He just can't escape his humanity. He's done everything he can possibly do to escape his humanity, but he can't do it. He can't be as pure as those animals. He can't be as free. So he has to try to punish them, to pull them away from their animality. It's the only thing he thinks he can do. He wants a transformation that he cannot have, so he'll force upon them a transformation that they don't want, they can't even conceive of. And of course, which is just abominable.